Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the fluoride deception right after this. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security, all right, but it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, our federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American. Now, that's according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. Closer to home, our state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems. Those systems contained 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, information about you is gained from about 63 sources. This information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how the government, how your bank or insurance company, businesses, and industry, how all of these institutions obtain all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? Well, knowing how this information is gathered and what information is being stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, then call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. And while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. You know, it's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call or you can get on the website. If you want to go to your computer, send us an email. Go to georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine when you get there, then send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about The Fluoride Deception. It's a book written by Christopher Bryson. You can probably get a copy of the book. Let me give you a source here. They got a publisher in here, but I would go to bravenewbookstore.com if you got a computer. If you don't, then just get on the telephone. It's 512-480-2503. If you got a credit card, you can just give them a credit card order right over the telephone. It's 512-480-2503. Now, that's called Brave New Bookstore in Austin, Texas. Now, if you want a copy of the book locally and you've got a Barnes & Noble or somebody there close by, just walk in and tell them, hey, I'd like to get The Fluoride Deception. The Fluoride Deception is the name of the book. Christopher Bryson, B-R-Y-S-O-N. Fairly new book. I saw the date here a couple days ago. It was, what, 2004? Something like that. Let's see if I got a number in here. Table of contents. Yeah, it's 2004. There's a copyright date on it, so it's fairly new. This is a who's who and whodunit. It's a book written about geniuses. The people who are the characters in here, like Harold Hodge, Leslie Groves, and a new character we're going to tell you about today named Robert Kehoe, K-E-H-O-E. These guys are geniuses. absolute genius. Evil genius, rotten, no good, perverse, wicked. But, you know, genius is genius, whether it's satanic or whether it's godly inspired. And you got to give credit where credit's due. These guys have sold deadly poison, put it in your water supply, they put it in your toothpaste, and you go out of your way and pay extra to get it. You go to your dentist, he fluoridates your teeth, and then he gives your children supplements of this deadly toxin, and you give it to your little kids. And you believe that that's good for them. Honest to God, you believe it. I did for years. I never believed it one way or the other. I didn't know. I didn't care. I trusted my government. I mean, after all, if you can't trust your government, who can you trust? So then I woke up one day and I said, I'm not so sure that the government's working in our best interests all the time. Maybe most of the time, but maybe sometimes they're not working in our best interest. Then I got to looking at it a little bit more, and I'd like you to write me an email and tell me, can you tell me in a single instance in which the government is acting in the best interests of the citizens and taxpayers of the United States? Just tell me one. Send me an email and say, here's where the government is acting in your best interest, working for you, the taxpayer. Because I'm pretty damn hard-pressed to find one of those. I'd like to know what my government's doing for all the money they take in the form of taxes from me. I mean, normally when I go down to the gas station, I fill up my tank, the guy's doing something for me, selling me something that I can use. I want you to tell me what in the hell the government's selling me that I can use. Something that I need. Something that's advancing my life, my liberty, my happiness. And I'm still looking. Well, it's not fluoride in my drinking water. And so I told you the other day I was over at the restaurant and I brought in my drinking water. The waiter was shocked. Absolutely dumbfounded. He said, sir, would you like me to get you some water? I said, son, I've got water right here. I brought it myself. If I wanted the water that you're serving me here, I would have left this in my car. I mean, this young fella probably has a, you know, he's probably going to college. I'd guess he's probably a college kid, you know, working his way through college. And he has a job there as a waiter. And I'm sure that he brushes with Crest fluoride twice or three times a day, probably believes he's doing himself a great service. He doesn't know that there's a problem. Now, I'm not out here crusading against fluoride. Put that out of your mind. I couldn't give a rat's you-know-what less about whether or not fluoride's in your drinking water or not. It's not in my drinking water. And I work hard to keep it out. Now, I can't do 100%, you know, when I open a can of string beans from Del Monte. You know, the stuff's going to have fluoride in it. So that's why I try to buy string beans that say organic on the label, because the people that are putting out organic, they're all aware of fluoride, chlorine, bad water, and so they go out of their way to try to do away with that, try to eliminate that. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that you and I can do to ameliorate the problem. Now, this guy Kehoe over here, he's a key player in this drama that's being acted out, this revelation that comes from the Manhattan Project, which comes from the secret government archives, which have been opened up now, you know, after 50 years and all the people are dead that they've dealt with. The lawsuits are long past and, you know, you can't sue them anymore. Then they come say, well, here's what we did to you. Well, you know, after you find out what the government's done to you four or five times, then pretty soon you can say, well, my God, if they've been doing that to me in the past, I wonder what they're doing to me right now and what they're planning to do to me in the future. Robert Kehoe and the Kettering Laboratory, Chapter 8. Now, from the darkness, it can be difficult to determine the source of a shadow. Well, Dr. Robert Arthur Kehoe of the Kettering Laboratory cast such a shadow over all of us. One of the darkest shadows in modern history. For more than 60 years, Americans breathed hundreds of thousands of tons of raw poison wafted into the atmosphere from leaded gasoline. This toxic air contributed to a medical toll of some 5,000 deaths a year from lead-related heart disease and an almost incalculable toll of tragedy in the neurological injuries and learning difficulties imposed upon children. One estimate based on government data suggests that from 1927 to 1987, 68 million children in the United States were exposed to toxic amounts of lead from gasoline until the additive was finally phased out in the United States. Just pause right here for a moment. This is another one of those success stories. We used to have leaded gasoline here in this country. For you people that are around the world, never heard of such a thing. Only in America could we think of something like this. Now, lead, like mercury, is a heavy metal, and it's a god-awful toxic poison. Lead poisoning. So we put it in paint. Well, you know, then children come along with pica. That's a mineral deficiency, and then they start eating the woodwork, and of course the woodwork's got paint on it, and so then they get toxic amounts of lead paint. Same thing with mercury and so on. Now, why we would want to put lead in our environment, I don't know. You know, you figure it out. It's money. It's money. We're not putting lead in the gasoline for no good reason. We're not putting lead in the paint for no good reason. It has some kind of an economic benefit. Nobody goes out of his way to put this additive in the gasoline unless it's going to do something that's going to sell more gasoline, which is going to, and it used to be called the Ethyl Corporation. So you used to say, well, do you want ethyl or regular? And so my dad used to always burn ethyl gasoline. Said the engine didn't ping or knock as bad, and, you know, or something. Not quite sure. Today we have 87 and 91, and I don't know, there might be another one there. You go fill up with gas. They call it octane now, see, today. Well, we all need motor fuel, you know, to put in our cars. We kind of presume that Congress and the FDA and the Department of Transportation is protecting us. They're not, but we assume that they are. And so this is the story on leaded gasoline. Now, that's not what the moral of the story is here. We're talking about fluoride. But it's just one more of the toxic poisons, you know, like asbestos, chlorine, fluoride, leaded gasoline, leaded paint, chemtrails. I mean, if I sat here and wrote down, you know, all of the poisons that we have in our environment that are just common, you know, day in, day out, you know, we use them every day, think nothing about them. You know, over time, these poisons build up in our body until such time as our immune system becomes overwhelmed and we come down with breast cancer or muscular dystrophy or Lou Gehrig's disease or Parkinson's or something else. And then, of course, we die from this, and then our death certificate says, oh, well, Joey died from Parkinson's disease. And Ethel over there, she died of breast cancer. And so on down the line. We didn't have this problem in 1900. All right, so you say today, well, I don't want to go back to 1900. Well, okay, well, accept death by poison because it's your lot in life. Hell, you've arrived, partner. Sit back and relax. Enjoy the ride. Now, some of the rest of us over here, we're a bit concerned about that, and I'm one of them. Let me raise my hand. I'm bummed out. I've got all these poisons in my environment, and some of them I can do something about, some of them I can't do too much about. Like, I can't stop that spring going on over the top of me. But I don't have to buy leaded gasoline. So as time progresses along, you know, we start to learn, well, what can I do for myself to protect myself from the chemtrails overhead or from the fluoride in my water? And the answer is activated charcoal. Very simple, activated charcoal. And I'm not even selling the stuff. Hey, don't send me a request. Don't send me an order for activated charcoal. Hell, you can make the stuff yourself if you had a little talent. Or, better yet, you can buy it. It's dirt cheap. I mean, it's just cheaper than dirt. You can go to any drugstore and buy activated charcoal. Medical grade. And here's what it does. There was a chemist, the guy that tested this out, I mean, at least in modern times. I mean, it's been around for thousands of years, but in modern times, about 1804, this French chemist, he goes out and he takes 3 grams of arsenic. I mean, that's enough to kill an elephant, I think. Or at least a horse, or if not, at least a big dog. That's a bunch. It's 3 grams. He took 3 grams with massive doses. Now, I don't know how much a massive dose of charcoal is, but massive doses of activated charcoal with no ill effects. And so we find, and most all doctors know this, they don't use it. It's cheap, and it's effective. Anything that's cheap and effective and solves a problem we don't want to use in medicine, there's no money in it. What we want is a long-drawn-out treatment over here that we can make some money off of. So this activated charcoal will detoxify your body. I mean, if you got poisons running around in your body, this activated charcoal, take them out. So tuck that one away in your heart. So if you get on activated charcoal, just go in any health food store and say to the guy in there, can you tell me the story about activated charcoal? Have you got a little book or booklet in here? They usually have them in a health food store. And they'll tell you about charcoal. It's just one of those cheap, effective, you know, old wives' tales, you know, that you hear about, you know, like my aunt Bessie and my granny knew about and used it for the last 5,000 years. That was before medical science came on the scene and started sending us over to poison control or something like that. All right, now, this guy Kehoe, he plays a pretty important part now in this human experimentation and fluoride. Now, for this good measure, we can thank Dr. Kehoe. He's a dark-haired, dark-eyed Kehoe, described himself as a black Irishman, and claimed to be descended from Spaniards who had been shipwrecked on the Irish coast during Elizabethan times. Now, the scientist possessed boundless energy and a keen mind, and he could also tell one hell of a dirty joke. Colleagues remembered. Others who confronted him professionally, however, remembered Kehoe as arrogant and aloof. So for almost 50 years, Kehoe occupied some of the commanding heights of the nation's medical establishment. He was at various points president of the American Academy of Occupational Medicine and president of the American Industrial Hygiene Association. He served as a consultant to the Public Health Service, the International Labor Organization, the Atomic Energy Commission. Kehoe also exercised a powerful influence on the publication of medical reports, since he sat on the editorial boards of leading scientific publications. He preached the gospel of leaded gasoline safety from his pulpit at the Kettering Laboratory for the duration of his entire scientific career. Kehoe did much the same for fluoride, with health consequences of a potentially similar magnitude. All right, so now let's stop here and think about this. Now, Kehoe over here, now he's preaching the safety of leaded gasoline. Now, we found out after, you know, many, many years, no, this stuff is not safe. And so, same thing with fluoride. One of these days, we'll wake up and we'll say, oh, yeah, this stuff isn't safe. Let's see, from 27 to 87, that's 37, 47, 57, 67, 77, 87, 60 years. He had leaded gasoline for 60 years. And these people are touting the safety of it. They're scientists. They're doctors. You can believe them. They're professionals. They have letters after their names. How many people did it kill? Well, they estimated 5,000 a year. 5,000 a year. 5,000 times 60. Well, it's only 300,000 people. 300,000 people died from leaded gasoline. We don't know how many people were mentally retarded and injured thereby. See what happens? And it's just in the interest of making money. By putting lead in the gasoline, we got a better performing fuel. And then we found out, oh my God, there's these side effects that come from this lead in the gasoline. And here's the kicker. These guys knew that the lead in the gasoline was bad for people and was causing them problems years before they outlawed it. Just like fluoride. Hell, they know what fluoride does. And they've known it from day one. Or at least from World War II on. But they keep putting it in there. And they keep telling you it's safe. That's exactly what they should do. As a matter, you know, as a lawyer, I would have to tell my client, you never make an admission that this stuff is unsafe. You always maintain that it's safe. Everybody that's been damaged by fluoride has an action against his dentist, has an action against some corporation, has an action against some government agency. The cost, the financial cost of the litigation in this thing would bankrupt the nation 10 times over. So there's no way in hell that they're ever going to admit to it. I mean, that's just where reality's at. And so I've explained to you, what we do is we deny it, and then we fight it tooth and tongue. So, number one, shut up about it. Number two, deny it. Number three, fight it tooth and nail. And then, finally, settle out of court without admitting any wrongdoing with those that you have to settle with. And in that way, you settle with one, and then you don't have to settle with the next 100. So you settle with about 1 in 100. And meanwhile, you're selling this product to all these people all the time. Now, the fluorine lawyers and the infectious idea of easy pickings. The spooked corporation stampeded Kehoe's laboratory following World War II. The great factories that had throbbed and roared for the long years of national emergency. These industries that had spewed unprecedented volumes of poisonous gas and smoke into the skies over numerous American cities and manufacturing areas. There were aluminum plants on the Columbia River and at Niagara Falls, uranium plants in New Jersey, Cleveland, and Tennessee, steel mills in Pittsburgh, gasoline refineries in Los Angeles, and phosphate plants in Florida. These were just some of the industrial operations that had won the war for the United States, but from which a steady rain of fluoride and other pollutants now fell, endangering the health of the workers in those factories and the people living nearby. Patriotic U.S. citizens tolerated the smoke of war, but when peace arrived, they turned to the courts. And perhaps the first to file suit were the injured peach farmers from the Garden State, downwind from DuPont's chamber works. They were quickly followed by numerous additional lawsuits alleging fluoride damage to crops, farm animals, and citizens. Soon we had claims and lawsuits around aluminum smelters from coast to coast. That's what Alcoa's leading fluoride litigator, Frank Simmons, recalled. Once this sleeping giant was awakened, claims and lawsuits were brought against all types of plants involving fluoride emissions, steel plants, fertilizer plants, oil refineries, and the like, he added. To battle this awakening giant, Siemens and attorneys for other beleaguered corporations organized themselves into a self-described Fluorine Lawyers Committee, which met regularly through the Cold War years. The committee would eventually include attorneys representing several of America's top corporations, including Alcoa, U.S. Steel, Kaiser Aluminum, and Reynolds Metals, Monsanto, the Tennessee River Valley Authority, TVA, Tennessee Corporation, and so on. Those corporations were guided by the needs of the fluorine lawyers and directed by a medical advisory committee of doctors from those corporations, and they funded the fluoride research at the Kettering Laboratory. Now, the gathering storm clouds were surveyed after the war at a confidential conference at the Mellon Institute on April 30, 1946. Among the guests filing through the ornately decorated aluminum doorways of the bunker-like structure on Pittsburgh's Fifth Avenue were representatives from several of the companies facing fluoride lawsuits and complaints, including Alcoa, Pennsylvania Salt, and Harshaw Chemical. Robert Kehoe dispatched a loyal young Kettering lieutenant to the conference. And although Edward Largent's only degree was a B.A. obtained in 1935 from Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, his willingness to sacrifice his own body and the bodies of others on behalf of the Kettering Laboratory's corporate clients had already propelled him to the front line of industry's defense against fluoride litigation. Starting in 1939, the giant Pennsylvania Salt Company and the Mead Johnson Food Company paid for a special experimental diet for the Kettering researcher. Pennsylvania Salt manufactured numerous fluoride products, including a cryolite pesticide spray, while Mead Johnson made a children's food called Pablum, containing animal bone meal. Bone meal can contain high amounts of fluoride. Largent, converted to a human guinea pig for the Kettering sponsors, eating, drinking, and breathing large quantities of fluoride for several years. Under the direction of a Kettering toxicologist, Francis Hayroth, the eager young researcher consumed fluoride in various forms, as cryolite, calcium fluoride, hydrogen fluoride, and sodium fluoroborate. As with similar experiments in which human volunteers breathe lead fumes in a Kettering laboratory gas chamber, the data were subsequently used to promote industry's position that moderate levels of fluoride or lead in the body were in equilibrium with the environment, and if kept below certain thresholds, were both natural and safe. Such a hypothesis was immensely practical, of course. Following Largent's wartime experiments eating cryolite, for example, the Department of Agriculture raised the amount of cryolite pesticide residue permitted on agricultural produce, an obvious windfall for the Pennsylvania Salt Company. Now in April of 1946, Largent was one of those sitting in the audience at the Mellon Institute as the grand old man of pre-war fluoride science. Alcoa's director of research, Francis Frary, took the stage, and Frary explained to the Mellon audience some of industry's worries, how fluoride accumulated in the human skeleton, and how coal had recently been identified as an important new source of airborne fluoride. Largent was well aware of the legal risks that fluoride posed to these corporations. He had been battling farmers who had launched court cases against several big chemical companies in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, alleging damage to crops and herds in a post-war barrage of litigation in the Philadelphia and Delaware Valley area. Largent described these as almost epidemic. Industry confronted a potentially devastating Cold War domino effect that America's industrial workers would follow the farmers into court, and Largent had been monitoring the fluoride exposure inside the Pennsylvania Salt Company's two big plants in Natrona and Easton, Pennsylvania. The x-rays showed bone changes in worker skeletons and pointed to a clear and present danger, he said. These x-ray data could easily be misused by dishonest people to conduct a probably successful attempt to obtain compensation, Largent told a colleague from the Hershaw Chemical Company in an April 1946 letter that discussed the importance of the pending Mellon Conference. The infectious idea of easy pickings may spread to include damage claims regarding occupational injuries, he added. Well, let's just pause here for a moment and let's take a look at what we see coming out of the first Gulf War. We have a problem called Gulf War Syndrome, and the government denies that it exists. 100,000 soldiers have it. Some of them have died from it already. It's probably aspartame poisoning. There are certain other chemicals that they were exposed to also, but more than likely the big culprit over there is aspartame. Now, I've reported on aspartame a time or two in the past. Again, aspartame poisoning can be cured. So if you're a Gulf War vet and you're suffering from Gulf War syndrome, that's an easy one to solve. It's no big deal. You need some professional help. I would grant you that. You probably need a naturopath rather than an allopathic physician, and you need to detox. Just that simple, and more than likely, activated charcoal will be at the top of the list. But nevertheless, notice here that industry's major concern after World War II is the litigation that's going to come out of this. So here's the modus operandi. Number one, shut up. Number two, deny it. And then number three, settle only out of court with those that you have to settle with. All right, now that's been the government's modus operandi. That's what industry's modus operandi is. It's been that way from day one. I have a student right now who's in litigation with the U.S. Army over a civil rights issue. In the final analysis, the case will not go to court. The government will pay off. He has to stay in the game until the case qualifies for court. And that'll be at pretrial conference. Then once the pretrial conference is over and the judge schedules it for trial, the other side will come over and offer a nuisance value settlement. And so you tell them, stick it where there's no daylight, and then in the final analysis, they'll settle with you out of court, because they have to. But most people, they will wear down. Most people, they will bankrupt or run out of money. Now, they came up with a very novel defense. It's called scientific research. See, one of the ways that we can deceive you is to give you so much information that you do not know what to believe. Let me repeat that. I can give you so much information that you won't know what to believe. So in sales, we use what we call the KISS principle. It's called K-I-S-S. Keep it simple, stupid. Okay, stupid, keep it simple. So when you ask the closing question, you ask, how do you want to pay, cash or check? Then you shut up, and then you think about it, and you'll answer, well, cash. Okay, well, now you've bought the product. You want red or purple? Then you shut up. It's called the closing question. Now, what I do, if I want to obfuscate this issue and confuse you, I say, well, which color did you want? You know, we have 47 different colors and 15 different piles in our carpet line. You can have red, green, purple. You can have purple, green, red. You can have combinations of the all of the above. See, now I've flooded your mind with so much information, you don't know what the hell to do, and you can't buy, you can't make a decision because there's so much to consider. It's where you're at with the 2008 presidential election. See, you've got so many candidates to choose from, you don't know what to choose, but you don't know what the issues are. Nobody wants to talk about the issues, so they just get up there and they talk about change. Changing what? When Barack Obama gets to Washington, what's he going to change when he gets there? Is he going to change the income tax? Is he going to change the Federal Reserve? He never did say. You're going to elect him, but he's never told you what he's going to do when he gets there to make change. Everybody's going to make change. All right, now that's what deception is all about. Now, God told you that the whole world is deceived. He told you that in Revelation 12:9. You didn't believe him. And one of the modalities that this guy, Kehoe, came up with, it was what we'll do is we'll go out and we'll do these scientific studies. And we'll put so much information out there, there won't be anybody who can come into court and testify with any certainty as to what the truth is. Obfuscate the matter with so many facts that nobody can decide. Now you tell me that's not genius. Well, it saved billions of dollars in litigation. It's gotten all these companies off the hook for the litigation. And it has sold fluoride, a deadly toxic poison, the water supply of half the people of America. And you people go to the store and pay extra to buy fluoride toothpaste. Now, you tell me that's not genius. All right, kids, I got to remind you that it's the halfway point here in this program. And as a result of that, you are listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law. From the scriptural perspective, now that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you do hear on this program are mine, or mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, and our phone number is 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about a guy named Kehoe, K-E-H-O-E, Chapter 8. And the strategy developed after World War II was endless studies, endless scientific studies. And so that's what you hear in the news constantly. A new scientific study says, a new scientific study reports, the journal of this or that says this or that. And they're all contradicting. They're contradictory. And so people will say, God, I don't know, is cholesterol good for me or bad for me? Is there good cholesterol or bad cholesterol? Should I watch my cholesterol or forget my cholesterol? Should I take this statin drug to reduce my cholesterol? You know, and all this confusion's out there. That's designed that way. Hell, that's designed. It isn't that we can't know, that we can't understand, we can't have the truth. But here's what we do. We put on a scientific study that's sponsored by the tobacco industry. What the hell kind of result do you think you're going to get from a scientific study from the tobacco industry? You're going to get a predictable result. Cigarettes are good for your health. So when I was a kid, back in the 1940s, they used to advertise Camel cigarettes were good for your T-zone. Big ads, you know, in Look Magazine, Life, and Collier's, and Post. Camel cigarettes are good for your T-zone. And then they'd have Lucky Strike cigarettes, you know. Smooth and easy on the draw. I'd tell you how it was good for your throat and blah, blah. And then they put menthol in cigarettes. My dad used to smoke cool cigarettes. Menthol-flavored cigarettes. And that was good for you. See, health. The health benefits of smoking. All right, so then some scientists, you know, independent guys come out here, you know, and they don't have any money invested in this. Now, the tobacco industry is making billions of dollars selling these cigarettes. So naturally, they have a lot of money that they're willing to spend to defend their product. Now, some guys come along, you know, these are scientists also, and they test monkeys and people, and they take a look at growing evidence of lung cancer and so on, and they come to a conclusion. They say, hey, smoking's bad for your health. And so now the tobacco industry, they come out and they sponsor some more tests, and then you've got the opposite tests, and then pretty soon there's so much information out there you don't know what the hell to believe. And that's a part of the deception. See, what you do, if you can't convince them, bedazzle them with your BS. That's what you do. Just bedazzle everybody with BS. All right, so Kehoe, he's got this job over here. So they're going to go in here, and in this chapter 8 explains how they go out and they do these tests. And there's a bottleneck comes in here. A guy has an actual successful suit against Reynolds metals. And that creates bad case law precedent. And what's Kehoe's solution? He says, okay, here's what happened in that case. They brought in an expert witness from England. So here's what we'll do. We'll go out and we'll create more tests, more scientific experiments. We will so obfuscate, we will so befuddle the issue of fluoride that when it's all said and done, there won't be an expert witness from any place in the world that can come in and testify against fluoride with any credibility whatsoever. And that's precisely what they did. They've created so many government studies. There's so much information out there on fluoride. That is pro-fluoride and anti-fluoride. You do the same thing with the Roe versus Wade thing. You go out here and you produce studies. You get two sides and two camps over here. You got the pro-life people and you got the pro-rights people. Are just about evenly divided in round numbers across the country. And you have demonstrations and arguments and fights and pickets and congressional hearings and court cases and all this coming down. When it's all said and done, you can never solve the problem because it's divided. You got so much information out there, nobody could come in here and testify as to what was what. It's obfuscation. It's confusion. And it's designed that way. It's designed right into the product. Now, that doesn't mean that you and I can't come to a knowledge of the truth. Abortion violates the law of God. It's passing your seed through the fire to Moloch. It's prohibited directly in Leviticus 20, verses 1 through 5. I mean, that's simple enough. You don't have to have a master's degree. You don't have to have a professor's tenure. And here's the creator of the universe says, don't do that. That abortion's bad. Stop it. Quit. Now, in order for us to promote abortion, we have to overcome that argument. So we attack the Bible and we say, well, the Bible is written by a bunch of screwballs and kooks over here that you can't trust anyway. And who could trust a Jew? And so you obfuscate the issue, you divide it up and fractionalize it into 476 denominations. You know, sects and cults and one thing and another. So that nobody knows what the hell to believe anymore. And you got two camps over here. You got the evolution camp and then you got the special creation camp. You got the local flood camp and you've got the worldwide flood camp. You got the rapture camp and then you got the tribulation camp. I mean, you see, you got this thing divided up and that's the point. That's the purpose. It's satanic in its origin. And it's genius. Absolute genius. There isn't anybody that could come into court and could testify on either side of the issue with any authority. None. Zero. It's a done deal. And so they're simply following that proven methodology. They've done it here with fluoride. They've sold you this deadly toxic poison. My God, it's worse than arsenic and strychnine combined. Put it in your drinking water. Put it in your toothpaste. You pay extra to go buy it. That's genius. You talk about salesmanship, you know, it's like selling a refrigerator to an Eskimo. That's what this thing is all about. It's sales. It's selling you something you don't need, can't use, shouldn't have, and don't want. And making you pay retail plus 10 to get 2. Now that's sales. That's what the whole story is all about. Now there were more human experiments also. The expanded research program quickly bore fruit. Both in fresh human experiments and in an influential scientific paper attacking Raj Rollam in January 1947 as industry checks for the fluoride research started to arrive in the Kettering Laboratory. Edward Largent looked around for more human subjects. He didn't have to look very far. Largent sometimes ate in the Kettering lunchroom with members of a local African-American family called the Blackstones, several of whom worked for the University of Cincinnati as laboratory assistants and as animal handlers. A group of black boys, a wonderful family, Elmo and Peanut and Gentry remembered Edward Largent years later. I was just kidding you the other day when I said, oh shucks, they're just blacks anyway. It just turns out here in chapter 8, they come up with a black family over here to experiment on. This is where we get this evolution. It really, really shines here. You see, we came up with evolutionary philosophy so that we could bypass Genesis 1, 2, and 3, because there's statutes in the Bible that prohibit discrimination. It prohibits oppression of a stranger within your gates. So we want to oppress the stranger within our gates. So we got to come up with some kind of a reason. So he said, well, look, see, the white man has evolved to a higher level than the black man. Therefore, the black man is an animal. So I need to lock him up in a cage or chain him up and put him to work in the cotton fields. Now, as time progresses along, you know, presidents and people that are influential come to the same conclusion. You know, they believe their own spin. They believe their own press report. So we throw the Bible out, we throw God out, we throw the Ten Commandments out, and we come up with a new paradigm. And this new paradigm over here is called evolutionary philosophy, which is discriminatory, and it's racist in its inception and its application. So if you black people out there want to know where racism comes from evolutionary philosophy and science. So let's have some more of it. That's the bottom line. Well, anyway, the Blackstone brothers had helped Dr. Robert Kehoe in his lead experiments. In 1947, a new item appeared on the Blackstone's menu, extra dietary fluoride. In May of that year, 41-year-old Elmo Blackstone began eating fluoride and carefully collecting his urine and excretion. The industrial experiments would continue for 3.5 years, during which time he would consume a startling 12,047 milligrams or micrograms, I don't know if it's milli or micro, but of fluoride in the form of sodium fluoride and sodium fluoroborate. Considerably more fluoride than even Largent had ingested. Now, these two guys are doing it voluntarily, so we don't have any complaints about people, you know, they're voluntarily using themselves as guinea pigs. The one I reported about you last hour, the report I gave to you yesterday, was that Hodge was doing this at the University of Rochester secretly in patients that were coming into the hospital, and they would give it to these people so that they could monitor what happened to them next. Well, naturally, some of them died. You know, they overdosed on some of them. Some of them just got sick, and some of them, you know, died maybe of Parkinson's disease years later. But we don't know about that, and we don't really care. Now, this is human experimentation. All right. Now, these people happen to be black. In one experiment, it began in June of 48. Elmo was given 84 milligrams of sodium fluoride each week in his food for 130 weeks. There's no surviving record of whether Elmo Blackstone experienced injury as a result of these experiments, but the historians Gerald Markowitz and David Rosner described similar Kettering human experiments with lead as particularly pernicious because their objective was not the discovery of a therapy for those with lead poisoning, but was to gather evidence that could be used by industry to prove that lead in the blood was normal and not indicative of poisoning by the industry. All right, now this is important. That paragraph right there is pretty important. Keep in mind here that when we talk about experiments, or when Katie Couric comes on the air at night, she's telling you about experimentation and work and scientific research to cure disease. Remember, it's always to cure disease. We're always looking for a cure. The purpose behind stem cell research is so that paraplegics can walk again. And then they get kind of carried away and makes you feel real bad. The real purpose for this stem cell research, boys and girls, has absolutely nothing to do with paraplegics walking. Nothing. Zero. Zilch. It's profit. How much money can we make? How much are you paraplegics willing to spend? How much are you taxpayers willing to spend to buy this product? So number one, they want the research to be funded by the taxpayers. That's why they sign contracts, research contracts, with the defense industry. In that way, they can get the defense industry to pay for it. Now, the industry, they benefit also, because the research institution over here, it could be a university or whatever this research institution is getting their money from the taxpayers to do the research that the industry is going to benefit from, because they're going to get the technology and they can go out in the marketplace and sell it right back to the same taxpayers that paid for the research to start with. So, okay, you got Teflon. You taxpayers paid DuPont to make Teflon or to discover it, to use it. Then DuPont turns around, registers and copyrights it, and goes out in the marketplace and sells it right back to you. All right, now, if that's what you want to buy, well, you know, go out there and get after it. But it would seem like to me that if I want to go out here and spend my money and research and come up with a product, that it ought to be on me, and then I ought to receive the benefits. That's what we used to think that capitalism was all about. We're not dealing with capitalism here. We're dealing with fascism. That's where the government and industry team up together to fleece the taxpayer to do the research and development, and then the industry takes the conclusion to the research and development and takes it out in the marketplace and sells it for a profit, and the government takes the technology and uses it for war so that they can use that war-making power, the atomic bomb or some nerve gas or whatever this technology, aircraft carriers or F-14 Tomcats or whatever it is, to dominate other nations in the world so that we can make them subservient to us and make them our vassals. Well, that's what we're doing in Iraq over oil, and Afghanistan over the pipeline and the heroin trade, and shortly a war coming to a city near you in Iran. I expected the war with Iran to have taken place already, but it hasn't. So it may not come until after the next president is inaugurated, but you can rest assured that war with Iran is coming. I mean, you got war with Iraq, war with Afghanistan, you got to get the middle country, that's Iran. It's coming. Just sit back and relax. Just taking a little longer than we had thought. Now, war is important because war also produces great profits. War itself is extremely profitable. And the defense industry depends upon war. And every once in a while, you got to have a war so you can use up all of the war material that you have already bought and stockpiled and used. Or you got to have the threat of war. You know, a rekindling of the Cold War. So the president the other day went over to Poland. Poland and Hungary or Czechoslovakia or someplace over there and says, hey, we're going to set up some anti-ballistic missile radar stations over here. Well, we already signed an agreement with the Russians that we wouldn't do that. And so the Russians, they took a look at that and said, well, hell, if you're going to do that, well, then we're going to terminate this treaty that you made with us back here in the 1980s. And then we're going to start stationing a lot of rockets over here on the border. It's a rekindling of the Cold War. And that's because most of our nuclear weapons, I say most, I don't know how many, but, you know, a lot of them, they're old and they need to be rejuvenated. And so as soon as the Soviets put their missiles back on the border, the president will come forward and say, oh my God, the Russians over here are presenting this great nuclear threat. We've got to go out here and we've got to upgrade our nuclear response to their threat. See how that works? Then we can go out here and justify spending billions of dollars remaking, retooling, and redoing all these nuclear weapons again. I mean, you don't have to use them, but you got to have the threat that we need to, you know, in our national interest. Well, this guy Kehoe over here, he's a great player in this game, and his real motivation is to protect industry from lawsuits, but it's also to make profits. And this book, Dynamite Book, explains to you how this works. It's called The Fluoride Deception. It goes way beyond fluoride. I mean, it's telling you where the bodies are buried and how the system works. Now, you know, you can sit there and say, well, I don't believe that. Why our government wouldn't do that? Okay. I'm a reporter. I'm not a persuader. My job isn't to get on the air and prove to you or to persuade you or to make you believe I'm right and you're wrong. I don't care. My job is to report facts. And this is a book full of facts. So I don't read much in the way of novels and entertainment. We try to concentrate on just factual information. Where's the body? Where was it buried? Who killed him? How did it happen? Who benefits from it, and can we prosecute him, and if we've got enough evidence to prove it. The guy's name is Christopher Bryson. Christopher Bryson. The book is called The Fluoride Deception. Largent's 1951 paper was influential among those for whom it was meant to be influential, so that in 1965, for example, the nation's leading expert, fluoride expert, Harold Hodge, could state that crippling fluorosis has never been seen in the United States. But Largent's paper also appears to have been a grim scientific hoax. At the end of his paper, the Kettering researcher had ostentatiously posed a question. Why did fluoride appear to affect American and European workers differently? Just why disability has not been recorded in American workers remains unanswered, Largent wrote. The simple answer is, the facts were hidden by the Kettering cover-up that misled a generation of medical researchers about the consequences of industrial fluoride exposure and sentenced many thousands of U.S. workers to undiagnosed fluoride injury. And just 3 years earlier, Kettering's Robert Kehoe had privately told Alcoa that 120 workers at its Massena aluminum smelting plant had bone fluorosis, and that 33 were severe cases that showed evidences of disability ranging in estimated degrees of up to 100%. And similarly, while Largent publicly reported no fluoride disability, privately three doctors had told him that workers' x-rays showed evidence of fluoride-linked medical injury, according to his personal correspondence and long counseled records. So if you workers are out there in the workplace, you think that OSHA and the EPA are out there to protect you, you got your head up the wrong end again. I'm just telling you. The purpose behind these scientific studies is over here, too, for the express purpose to obfuscate the truth. And they do a marvelous job of it. They've got studies and studies upon studies upon research studies upon research studies. When it's all said and done, you can't get a dime from your Gulf War injuries, troops. And the same thing is true here. It protects the insurance industry, and it makes you the experiment, and you, the worker, are the scapegoat. That's the bottom line. All right, so we're not trying to get it changed. We're not out here telling you who to vote for. You can vote for anybody you want, but it isn't going to change anything. No matter who you elect, it isn't going to change one thing. All right, guys, we're out of time again. We're going to have to remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. And we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.